Greetings, everybody, and welcome to Shared Chats Volume 9. And live on the show from Palm Springs in America is the one and only Harvey Lisberg. Harvey, thank you for coming on Shared Chats.
No, it's a great pleasure. I like your show. I've listened to them and they're fascinating. So I'm very pleased to be on it and hope we have a good talk.
Well, that's really great. Well, you know, it was my good luck, my good fortune that I can't remember, this must have been about 5-6 months ago, that suddenly notification of your book, I'm Into Something Good, floated into my computer. And I went, Harvey Lisberg, I don't believe it, because we hadn't seen each other for a long, long time. So I was very keen, and then we got a hold of each other, and it was, you know, all really, 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 really great. And I'm very pleased that you're here. So I want to start, and this is odd thing to start, and I don't know why this came into my head, except that I was a big fan, and I still am, with a lot of respect. Charlie Watts, the drummer of the Rolling Stones, the late Charlie Watts, what a guy. And I just know what you thought of him.
Well, I've been a few concerts with him. And Nebworth, 10cc, played with the Rolling Stones, and Herman's Hermits, about 8 years prior to that, played with him in Philadelphia. I thought he was a nice guy, very steady guy. He had a long, long marriage, and was funny. And I always liked the story that probably you've heard, but was when Mick Jagger was doing some interviews or anything and getting a bit bored. He says, "Oh, go and talk to my drummer over there." And of course, they went and Charlie Watts gets up, gets hold of Mick Jagger, pins him against the wall, and says, "I'm not your fucking drummer. You're my fucking singer."
It's a great story. He was a very cool person, always immaculately dressed. You know, he was just a very cool individual character, I thought.
And I must say, I liked all the Rolling Stones. To me, they were an intelligent band. You know what I mean? They weren't idiots. They were sort of university trained, and if Mick Jagger made a comment like, I'm just a stripper on the catwalk, when they asked him, what does he do? I mean, he's clever. These guys are not idiots. And the songs they wrote and the music. In fact, they were kind of dwarfed a bit by the Beatles, but they stood up well, and they're still touring today.
Just on that note, I happen to be refreshing my memory about you and your book. There's a lovely bit in it, really, which talks about when you had left Manchester University and you'd gone and got a job as a trainee accountant, I think in the Hamden, I think they're called, in Manchester. And it was the whole place was cooking, because the Beatles were really beginning to cook. And I just thought that's such a really great snapshot. And I wondered if you recall it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Manchester in the 60s was probably the top club town in England. You know, lots of clubs. Originally, there were jazz clubs, and then they became skiffle, and then obviously every group under the sun. Before Herman's Hermits, there was the Hollies, and there were lots of other bands, Pete MacLean and the Clan, the Big Three. There were lots of bands that never made it. And you could always go and see live music. So it was buzzing from that point of view. The good thing about Binder Hamlin was they represented the great organization in London, which more or less controlled the entertainment business. They had the three brothers, Del Font, Lou Grade, and Leslie Grade.
Yes.
And the three of them were, London management controlled the Palladium, talk of the town, that was that. And then Del Font was the Royal Variety Show, and then Lou Grade with Titanic, the film, which he lost so much money that he said it would have been cheaper to lower the ocean than what it cost. And 10 years later, Titanic won about 12 Oscars for.
Yeah.
It's an amazing story that
Titanic. Bad luck.
But It was so I was writing songs and trying to get them placed with people, and they weren't that great a song, but they were okay. And the Beatles suddenly happened, and Epstein was the manager, and he had no knowledge of the music industry. And he got more and more powerful. I thought, right, well, I can do
Yeah,
that.
that inspired you.
Absolutely. It sort of, yes, it was a light. So somebody with no experience could go into a new profession and take over the world, which is what he did, really.
Yeah.
It's incredible when you think about it. He was what the furniture sales people, were they, or
Well,
something.
didn't wasn't he wasn't didn't his family, Brian Epstein's family, own
Thames
record
Enterprise.
shops?
Yeah, there were record shops and furniture shops and all sorts of things. I mean, there were retail stores, yes, that's
Yes,
correct.
yes.
But he had no knowledge of the artistic side of it all.
Did you meet him at that point or not?
Well, Danny, my partner, Danny Bitesh, he did the first Beatles tour with
Wow.
Wilkerson. I mean, that's what, so when I, everything is, there's so much in the book, as you know, and it's
Yeah.
so many topics, it's very hard to keep on one subject. But once he'd done that, I said to Danny, look, we've got to start promoting things. You've got the biggest card in the world. You were the first
No,
people to promote the
I can see
Beatles.
that. But hang on a second, handbrake. You know, because what I'd said to you some time ago is I'm very interested in the idea of luck. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I just think we have luck in our lives. So to me, you met Herman's Hermits, right? Peter Moon, and went, okay, well, if I get a couple of bob from someone and a couple of bobs from someone else, and right, I can do it. Did you feel that was just predestined? You know, well, I, you know, what did you think at the time? Because it went very quickly.
I couldn't get my songs placed with anybody, so I thought the idea was to get my own group and they would do my songs. That was the idea of getting a group. I arranged something with the Manchester Evening News. I can't remember, I really can't remember how, but I heard about this band that was in Davy Hume and a youth club. And I went along there with the purpose of signing them, or if they were as good as the rumours were. And I went there, and every time they did a number, the stage was charged by these screaming girls. I thought I'd won the national lottery. And I thought, right, this is it. It'd be, watch out, Brian Epstein, here I come.
Yeah.
And I got hold of Peter, and I went back to his house. And he said, and I started fiddling on his piano. I'm an amateur vamper on the piano. And I was playing Tell Me What I Say by Ray Charles or something like
Oh,
that while
brilliant.
he was getting his parents in. And he came and he said, hey, Harvey, did you want to join the band? I said, no. I said, I want to manage the band and I want you to do my songs. And then it happens, I got the first B-side as a result of that, which was really good.
Very
Having
funny.
gone through a whole scenario. Talking about luck, well, you've got to analyze luck with timing,
Yeah, okay.
because you can have, if you're diamond to something good today, you're not sure that it would be a hit.
Yeah.
But in the euphoria of the 60s, an up song written by Goffin King, which was magic before you, as soon as you put it on, it might be magic today, but it wouldn't have had the same
Yeah,
effect then.
no. I agree with you. Timing is all part of that. But you know,
Ever.
you soon met a chap for whatever reason I used to know, Derek Everett, and then very nice man.
Well, this is a really embarrassing story. But anyhow, I'll tell you two stories related to this because the first one is a classic. Scene at 6:30 was the best TV show. The only outlet that anybody could get on was being a group, and the group, the Beatles were on it. And I wanted to get Herman and the Hermits on Scene at 6:30, and I kept writing to Johnny Hatton, sending him letters. So, okay, nothing happened. So I took the lunchtime at Binder Hamlin. We went down to Granada Studios, and I said, "Is Johnny Hatton there?" He said, "Oh yes, he's in there." I think it was like Studio 27. I said, "Where's that?" He said, "It's the pub across the road." So I went across the road, and I go into this pub, and he's there with, I think it might have been Michael Aspinall. I don't know, some other famous broadcaster. And they were drinking. I said, "Hi, I'm Harvey Lisberg." He said, "Oh, hi, Harvey. Yes, I got your letter. Seen the photo of the band. Yes, we must come and see them sometime." I said, "Well, what about now?" They said, "What do you mean now?" I said, "Well, they're doing a lunchtime set at the Plaza. Why don't you come with?"
My God.
Johnny Hammer's a bloody joker of the first order, a practical joker.
Yeah.
He told the other guys with, "Look, we're going to sit down and watch this band. Whatever happens, don't show any positive reaction."
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Just keep a deadpan face. So we're at the Plaza Ballroom, and I'm sitting at this table, and I'm watching them. The group are going down a storm, and there's not a sign that, "Oh, Jesus, I made a mistake here. This is definitely not right." And at the end of the show, they still didn't say anything. So at the end of the set, I said, "Well, did you like them? Be in the studio tomorrow at 4 o'clock. That was all he said, right? Be in the studio tomorrow. I'll have them on tomorrow. Be in the studio. So the next morning, all the boys had jobs. And I thought he was playing a practical joke on me. So I phoned him. I said, "Look, were you joking about that?" He said, "No, they were terrific." Right. The relevance of the Plaza was it's a ballroom, and I was very friendly with the manager there called Terry Devine. I went into his office and I saw some heading with EMI on it. And I said, "What's that?" He said, "Oh, it's a letter." I said, "Could I have that letter? Do you mind?" "No, not at all. Take it." So I take this letter, and it's from somebody called Derek Everett. So I wrote Derek Everett, "I've heard all about you. Would you care for a meeting? And I'll send a photo of Peter Noon." I went down. And he wrote back, said, "Yes, sure, please do come and see me."
Blimey.
And I walk through the door in the office. He says, and as I walk through, he said, "You know, Harvey," he says, "I don't have anything to do with artists and repertoire. I just physically put records in Mecca ballrooms. That's all I, and all the ballrooms. I'm
nothing really?
To do with it." Yeah. And I thought, "Oh, no, man, this is a real goof. What do you do?" Because I've told him the whole letter how great he is.
Yeah.
We all know about him. And he says, "But I know this kid just around the corner called Mickey Most. He's just had a hit with the Animals. We got to get out of here
or
whatever
it House was. The Rising Sun."
And so he said, "If you want, go and see him." And I thought, well, I'm in London. I might as well do that. So I did that. I went to see Mickey Most, gave him the picture. And he said, "Yeah, it looks quite good." And I tried to get Mickey Most to come and see them. I'm driving him mad. And I had the brainwave, well, I'll send him two tickets, air tickets, to come and see them. I'll put him up at the Midland Hotel, which was the best hotel.
He'll
bite. And he did. He came up, and I took him to Bolton. So it's the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good was he liked the band. The bad was, on the way back in the car, he said, "You'd have to get rid of two of the band before I sign them."
And
the ugly is me having to get the band, get rid of them. So that was my scenario.
Yes, and that's where when you told the guy, he lay down in the middle of the road, and you thought, oh my God.
Yeah, it was terrible. And
what happened to him?
He died, actually. When he just disappeared off the scene. I was scared stiff that he was really looking...
Going to come and bash you up.
I was going to get a knife in the back for the first 2 weeks. But actually, he was really... He turned out to be quite a nice guy, you know. I didn't know him as such because I was in fear of this thug, you know, but he wasn't. He was okay. He'd done a lot of work on the band. And he was one of the original members. And it is hard to get rid of people. But as Peter said to him, we can't get anywhere without a recording deal. And it indirectly through Derek Everett. And Derek Everett then subsequently did go into the A&R. Then he went on to MCA. And that's where we got Tony Christie to him through that situation. And I got very friendly with Derek Everett, who was a very nice man.
And really, what's extraordinary is the... a huge success that you had with Herman's Hermits in America. Unbelievable.
Yes. Yeah, it was. There was an element of, well, as I said in the book, I could do no wrong. You know, it was embarrassing, actually.
Yeah.
You know, it really was. I even in the casino, I could do no wrong. I went to London and was at the Crockford Club, I think. Cromford or Crockford Club, one of those clubs.
Crockford.
Gambling club. And I was with my, and it was 1:30 in the morning, and they wanted to go to bed. And I said, "Well, look, I'll keep him playing. I'm playing roulette. The odds are madly against you. You don't win a roulette. Anyhow, I was winning every spin. I said, as soon as I lose, we'll go home. And I left at 4:30 in the morning, paid for all their weekend and everything, and won thousands of pounds.
Really?
Mickey Most, he got House of the Rising Sun, then that went massive. Everything we touched went to gold. And then we came to America, and Peter got very popular, with that cute, you know, JFK look. It's really yes. good look and very young. And everybody in America is seduced by the English accent. You do well yourself there. Anyhow, that's what turns you on. But they love hearing the English voice, you know.
Yes, yes, oh, yes.
Harvey, stick around. I'm buying a bloody toothpaste. Thing. Stick around. We love to hear you talk. Yeah, right. It was a good calling card.
But how old were you then?
24.
Blimey. Right.
Well, I started at 23, so it was a one-year turnaround before things were really happening. And by the time 1965, I had a flat in Park Lane and stayed at the Waldorf Hotel. I was really living the poor man's life, you know, chauffeur-driven everywhere. It was only when I got married to Carol in 69 that I started driving again. That's terrible.
Extraordinary, extraordinary. Just going backwards again, just, you know, because I think this is important, that Kennedy Street, the street, was near where you lived or worked?
Kennedy Street was the centre of town. There was a club called, I think, the Guys and Dolls.
Right.
And there were four partners, and they then opened an agency. And I was having a lot of success with Herman. Danny was having success with Freddie and the Dreamers and various other acts. And I watched him and I said, look, your partners do nothing. You have a meeting.
Because he had four partners or something.
Four partners. He had 20% or five of them altogether. Yes, yeah, so that's 20% each. And they used to meet once a month and probably go to the French at the Midland, have a meal, have a little chat and then go down. And he did all the work, you know. And it really got big. It was good. And I said, look, why don't you I'll buy them out. And then we'll put all our resources together, which we did.
Right.
We bought them out. And then at that stage, we had 1, 2, and 3 in America in Billboard. Because we had, you know, I think Mrs. Brown, Freddie the Dreamers, and Wayne Fontana were 1, 3, 1, 2, and 3. And that's not bad for a Manchester firm that didn't go to London. So that was
it's amazing.
As I say, everything turned to gold.
You know, for people who don't know about the history of the music business in, you know, and the North, you know, Kennedy Street became the big thing. You know,
there's so much talent in the North as well, you know, so it was good. We didn't, every time we did a TV appearance, although originally Top of the Pops was in Manchester, then moved to London, and then you couldn't do anything, recording or anything, you had to go to London. There was that dreadful journey down there, you know, it was just a pain.
Yeah.
We thought, well, we'll build our own studios and things like that. We did everything Central Land Manchester. I mean, I could have gone and lived in New York quite comfortably in 65. I mean, there's so many offers and so many people.
Yeah, of course.
But I was happy with my home life. I love my parents and we had a great relationship. And it was a fun relationship because my father had difficulties. He was very successful when he got back from the war. He was very successful. Then they had rough times. And all his friends kind of disappeared, which really pissed me off, no end.
Yeah.
And then I started to happen, and then they all sort of appeared again. You know, it's sort of the fair weather friends, you know what I mean? As long as you're doing well, they want to be there.
Yeah, no, I get it. You know, Kennedy Street in the 70s, 80s, 90s. I mean, I've even just looked at the website. I know it's different ownership. But it's, you know, it was such a huge thing, you know, concert tours all over the North. And
I bought in 64 and I sold out in 96. But in the meantime, in 74, we sold half the company to the Grades.
Oh, did you? Right.
Because Leslie Grade wanted Danny and myself, two nice Jewish boys, to look after Michael, who was running London Management.
Right.
And we were very happy because, right, great, we'll get all our acts on in the Talk of the Town, the Palladium, fantastic. It would be a fantastic symbiosis. But it didn't work out like that. First of all, Billy Marsh probably didn't like us. I don't really care, but, you know, he was sort of, he probably, oh, what the hell are they getting involved for? You know, they tried to keep, we were kind of kept down. And I loved Leslie Grane, and you know, just before I'm Not in Love came out, I phoned him and I said, look, we're not getting what we wanted out of your lot, because they're not helping us. We had Neil Sedaka in the studio. We wanted to do Talk of the Town. We never got it. We wanted the Palladium. We never got it. I said, look, it's not working out. Can we buy ourselves back? And he says, yeah, same price. So they bought us. We bought it back, and then we owned it completely. But we had nothing but good things to say about Leslie Grade. He was fantastic. What a really? Character he was. Yes, you could base your... He was
But he was the lesser known, wasn't he? I mean, in the sense
he
of...
He was the part. Trust me, that guy. I mean, he just knew how to deal with everything. I mean, he was the schmoozer, you know. His best friend was Walter Winterbottom. He's a mad Arsenal fan, by the way. And so I at the time, I said, Leslie, can I have tickets for the... Yes, I've got you two tickets for the cup final. So I go down there. I'm in the bloody restaurant. Morecambe and Wise on one side. This one and that one. Everybody. It was like a happening place. Wimbledon, yes. We've got tickets to go to Wimbledon. He had his fingers in every single pie. He was a genius.
Yeah. And his way,
my favourite story about him, which is colossal. He and his brother, I think, went to see this act at the Palladium. And after the show, they went round backstage and said, God, it was fantastic. You must sign. We've got to sign it. And the guy said, I can't. He said, you've got to sign with us. What's the reason? He said, well, I'm already signed to you.
Good story. Yeah, we like that. We like that. Now, tell me, what came first? Graham Gulman or Carol, your wife?
Oh, Graham, miles before. Yes, I mean, Graham, I was 1964, I got married. Well, having said that, I've got a photograph of Carol and myself on my 8th birthday party. So the families sort of knew each other. I went there.
Yes.
Carol was, I married in 1969.
Right.
Graham had already had his first... you know, up and down. He was in a kind of a middle stage at that stage, which is pre-10cc, and just with he'd done a cast 9 months in America, and of course he married Carol's sister.
But had he married her before you married Carol?
No, it was coincidental. We found out we were going out with at the same time.
And I mean, Graham Gulman is a very talented writer, and you know, going back to the Hollies and all sorts of things. Can you sum that up? I mean,
He was a genius. It's a wonderful guitarist, very musical. Loved his main love of life was his music, really.
Right.
You know, I think Susan suffered as a result of that. But you know, that's what happens. I mean, he really was into it. He was just very talented, and his father was a genius, which didn't hurt, and came up with some wonderful lyrics. And, you know, I mean, he was just a great songwriter.
What was the first things that he really had success with?
Well, the first song was For Your Love.
Right.
Well, I kind of got him out of another band. He was in a band called The Whirlwinds. And,
right.
I don't know why, but I was at this place called the Jewish Lads Brigade, which was the equivalent of a YMCA.
Yeah.
And the Whirlwinds used to practice every week. And I still to this day don't know why I, who was an article clerk, nothing to do with the music business, was listening to them every Monday night and trying to get hold of their manager and maybe get involved with it. I used to go to Graham's house every... first of all, I asked Graham, I said, why don't you start writing songs? Because he was in a band and he'd had a few records and they hadn't happened. And I said, why don't you try writing yourself? Because even the B-sides weren't written by Graham. I think Lowell wrote one of the B-sides.
Right.
He was involved. It was a tightly knit thing, you know. Everybody lived near each other. It was almost like a ghetto. And going back to Graham again, he just was an amazing guitarist. I mean, in 10cc, I mean, Eric was regarded as the lead guitarist, but I mean, Graham could hold his own with anybody.
He was a guitarist. He was multi-talented.
And he was at a horrible school, a comprehensive school, which was way down the line, and I don't think they helped at all. And then he was working in a shirt shop, and I managed to seduce him out of that when he agreed to join me, when I'd had some success with Herman Sermitz, and revisited him, put him on a wage, as I did with Kevin Law, with Rice Webber, you name it. We gave everybody like 10 quid a week or 5 quid a week just to keep the wolves at bay. And he was like a brother. We were so close. It was ridiculous. So
what did he do for the Hollies?
He did, first of all, he did Look Through Any Window, which was, he did Bus Stop. Obviously, that was a great song. But the Look Through Any Window was the first, which he did with Charlie Silverman, who was my partner at the time with Herman's, managing Herman's Hermits.
Right.
And then we managed Graham. And I said to Charlie, I didn't want our names on this writers. We're managing this writer. We're building him, but we're not building us.
You're not building ourselves,
Consequently, I didn't push myself at all as a songwriter. And he'd be, and without me knowing, he on the, you know, Silverman, Goulman, and I said, what the hell's going on? And Jaime wrote the lyrics as well. So Jaime used to get paid, I think, from Charlie. Yes, Charlie used to pay Jaime so much, and there was like a three-way split.
Right.
And then it was awful. When Jaime died, Charlie never paid Betty, the widow, anything. You never saw a penny after that.
Oh, dear.
It was awful. It was horrible. I mean, you know, it's not right, but anyhow.
But there we go.
There we go.
But, I mean, Graham is, has got quite a serious biography in terms of songwriting and playing in bands.
In the 60s, it went from For Your Love, Heart Full of Soul, I thought of the title of that, Evil Hearted You, Pamela Pamela. They did a lot of concerts, and they were very good concerts, 10cc. I mean, Graham's doing it today. I mean, the Graham band of today, in my opinion, is probably as good as any. Except, you know, Kevin Lull were that 4-year period when the original 10cc had it had its magic. You know, that was a real fusion of two sides, you know, Graham and Eric and Kevin Lull sort of editing each other and battling and getting their fusion and getting the most amazing records like Rubber Bullets, and you know, it's just incredible. They were brilliant. I mean, they could have been a lot bigger. And of course, then Eric had an accident and that, everything. There's lots of things that went wrong.
Right.
But quite obviously, if that happened today, it wouldn't be so terrible for a member of a band to go off for a year and do an album, then go back into the band again. But in those days, that didn't happen.
Just before we go into talking about the snooker sports side, what I was very interested to know that you worked, I think it was Graham was working with Andrew Gold.
Yes, that was interesting. We finally got on Warner Brothers Records in America, having had about so many failures on Mercury. And they suggested Andrew Gold came over as a producer for 10cc, and then they sort of bonded together at that stage. And then when everything fell to pieces with the punk era and everything, Graham and Andrew got together, I think, around about 85 and started doing some beautiful music as well.
Right.
And I think that was Graham's happiest time in his life. Because whatever you say about 10cc, I could say that Herman and the Hermits were in love with each other as we went through the euphoria of going from nothing to the biggest band in the world. And everybody was round each other's shoulder and everything was hunky-dory. You couldn't say that about 10cc, because they'd be probably battling.
There was lots of angst.
Whatever it was.
Did you really enjoy your time, you know, managing snooker players, Jimmy White and...
I loved it. I loved it. It was holiday camp. It was incredible.
It didn't worry you that you didn't know the world? I mean...
I got more publicity in 6 weeks of snooker than I had in 20 years of rock and roll. It was the hottest thing in the country. And we got this Jimmy White, who was an exciting player. And it was just fantastic. And I got the chauffeur. Well, I did have a chauffeur then, because I wasn't with Carl. I used to go to the Crucible. I was driven there in the morning, green room, free drinks, food. And guess what? In the hall, there's Ladbrokes Hills and Corals. You can bet on every frame. You can bet on every horse race. So I was there drinking. This was my management.
It was like
a complete holiday camp from morning to night for 3 years, with the most ridiculous things happening all the time. And we managed Willie Thorne. Tony Knowles came into the camp. We handled it. Alex Higgins. Oh, my God. It was a boys' night out.
Was Danny involved in that or not?
Danny, yeah. Well, we had a firm called Sports World, and Danny was involved, obviously, but it was kind of, yeah, indirectly involved, because Sports World was Jeff Lomas, Roy Speaker worked for Danny, myself, and another guy called Fred Summers. So I'm trying to remember. I'm sure Danny was involved. Yeah, he would have been. Danny was involved in everything. I wanted the 10th Kennedy Street to be the biggest company in the world, and I wanted to go public. That was my aim in life. Wow. I thought that's the only way I could capitalize on the success.
Yes.
Otherwise, all that's happening is I'm spending all the money. Danny's a very careful person, 9 to 5, 9 to 7, whatever,
yeah.
Works every day. Everything. And I was the kind of guy that came in with crazy ideas, which are too crazy for words. And then one might happen, and that's great. And I wanted to represent all classical music. Only one fault. You couldn't, because it was controlled by Gabay. You can stand on your bloody head, you won't get arrested.
Yeah,
so my idea was, if you play classical music, you don't have to worry about who the artist is. You know, you just put the concert on and make them. You couldn't get in there.
Yeah.
I wanted to get into comedy. So we got an act called Cannon and Ball, actually, at the time, indirectly through Stuart Littlewood, who very kindly took him off our hands when they got some success. And then Michael Hughes controlled all the people in Liverpool, all the comedians, so you couldn't get a smell in there. As regards sport, I managed Gary Owen, who's the England under-21 football captain, and tried to get him transferred to Manchester United, and they put the phone down on me. So we don't speak to managers. But I couldn't develop anything.
So Danny, that's why you wanted to turn it into a public company and then actually...
Well, we had the publishing. We had everything going for us.
Yeah. So what happened?
But Danny didn't want it. Danny just refused point blank, because... I don't think he wanted other people looking over his shoulder.
Yeah.
And he never spent any money, Danny. So he always, he was sort of he amassed his fortune.
Yeah.
I did the opposite.
You spent yours.
Absolutely. It's like the joke. Have you heard the joke about the two Jewish women that are talking to each other? And Mrs. Levy, how's your son doing? She says, oh, she's not too bad. He says, He's got a nice house in Surrey, and he's got a yacht in the south of France, and he's a lawyer. He's very nice. And what about you, Mrs. Carr? Oh, God, it's terrible, my son. It's terrible. What do you mean? He says, hasn't he got a Rolls Royce? She says, yes, got a Rolls Royce. And he's got a plane under it. Yes. And he's got, a house in Park Lane as well. What's the problem? Only earns £15 a week. So it's the same thing. You know, you can always spend more. You can always spend more than you earn. And the biggest fool can ask more questions than the wisest man can answer.
Yeah. So I sent you a dashboard of dials, of your mental health dials. And I said, could you choose two that were important to you as a sort of, yeah, these two make sense. What are they?
Yeah, stress is a very, it's horrible. Yes, I have a lot of stress in my life, yes. I think all my stress would be financial, and this problem of spending more than you earn and not being able to say to Carol, no, I don't want to have a Louis XIV armchair in a cottage, which we don't use. You know, that sort of thing. I always wanted to please people, and that sort of hurt me in a way. I couldn't control my own expenditure, because I always thought money would always come in, and it always did. So it wasn't that. Be sensible. What happens if it suddenly dries up? I didn't think like that. So there's always a stress. And if you're gambling as well and you're losing, and you've got, you owe the bookmaker's money, you owe the mortgage company money, you owe this one, that one. Again, it all piles up on top of you. And that gives you the stress, which I don't think is very good for you as far as a health concern. I think stress is the worst thing of all.
Yeah. Well, I think stress...
And you're saying, how do you deal with it? Well, I didn't drink to deal with it.
Yeah.
I did do exercise at one stage when I was that age, that exercise was fun. Used to go walking and things like that, which I liked doing. Swimming I liked. I quite liked exercise. I think exercise at my own level, not because I have to do a regime and lift weights and God knows what.
Yeah.
I just like walking, fresh air, golf.
Well, that's good. No, that is good for stress. Also, not putting yourself in a stressful situation.
Well, that's difficult.
That is difficult. I know. But
because you're seduced by, well, it's not only the gambling, it was, I always wanted, I suppose in a way I was competing in the rat race, always being up with the Joneses creates a tremendous pressure on you. If I'd have stayed in my first house and I'd do what Danny did, Danny used to go on the same holiday every year or two for 2 weeks to somewhere, he bought a flat there and he went there every 2 weeks and I went around the bloody world.
Yeah,
you know, five-star hotels.
But you have to be true to yourself, don't you? I mean, that's the
thing. When I was 50, I said to Carol, look, I want to go around the world with you. I don't want to do it when I'm 80, when I can't move. And we went to every country. We went right around the world on a wonderful world trip. And I never regretted that. Whereas I couldn't see somebody like Danny ever doing that in a million years because...
No.
A, who wants to see Manchester City at the weekend or whatever. No, I mean, look, Shaka and Asongu, you know?
Yeah.
And my partnership with Danny was priceless. You had one person that's dead careful, the other person that's a lunatic, and then the two come together. And when things are going well, boy, they're going well. But when things aren't going well, then there's a tension because the tension also is the stress. Because you're taking money out of the company, so the other guy's got to take it out, even though he doesn't want to. So you can't build up the company because one partner's taking all the money out. I mean, I acted like an idiot, you know. But you know, I was out of control actually.
No, I'm sure. Yeah, it's interesting.
And I wasn't alone. I mean, I could never understand people like Brian Epstein. He spent, you know, hours at a roulette table, cover every number, and. what's all that about? You know, I mean, the guy was the biggest thing. I mean, can you imagine?
Didn't last.
Nope.
Well, that was a bit sad.
Shame, really. He was a nice guy.
Okay, we're gonna come up to the end now. What have you learned from writing this book, Living Where You Are? I don't know how long you've been in Palm Springs.
Since 1990.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I was a snowbird for probably 30 years, and we bought a house in 2005.
Right.
And then with COVID, I've not been back to England. And that's when the book evolved from being here, COVID.
Did you enjoy writing it, or did you hate writing it and now enjoy it?
What I did was, I Charlie Thomas wrote the book. He was originally a sports guy. On Sky TV, and then he did the 10cc documentary BBC because he did the documentaries. I didn't know he even wrote anything. I just said, look, would you like to do a book, come up to Palm Springs, spend a few days and let's put it all down. So he came up like we're talking now, and we talked for about 4 hours a day, and then he put the great thing was he put his angle on it. He was a fan at Nebworth. He was at that concert. So I was in the back having rows with Bannister for all the problems. And he was in the front with all the drug-orientated marijuana smoke that was going around. And so we had both sides of the story. And also, he described it from his point of view. So it's really quite good. So when you hear about half of it is probably... Some of it is his, but the stories are all mine, obviously. And the stories are priceless. And the thing about it is it's brought me so much information after the book, things I don't know, like I told you the story about Johnny Hamp. I didn't realize that, but it was in his book, you know.
And you presumably reunited with a few chums and from people.
Oh, unbelievable. I spoke to a guy yesterday I've not spoken to for 71 years. That takes some dude, doesn't it?
That does. Well, blimey, when you're only 50, that's quite extraordinary.
And he lives in some obscure place. I can't remember. It's Crete or somewhere. All these people live all over the place, Indonesia. It's incredible. It's a small world.
Wow. So have you got any parting words for us, Harvey? That's what we want to know here on Shed Chats.
Yeah, I think if people say, why was I successful or what was the main contributing factor? I think, well, firstly, I had a tremendously strong upbringing with lots of love. So I was very, very confident all the time and nothing frightened me. And I think you've just got to, if you believe in something, you've just got to go for it. And you've got to be prepared for a lot of rejection. And I think you've not got to really take any notice of the rejections. I think you've just got to keep plowing on, because so many people would tell me how rubbish Herman's Hermits were and what I was wasting my time for. And those people just knew nothing. They just talk for the sake of talking. And they're very cynical. People are very cynical. You know,
malicious in a way, yeah.
You've got to be positive about everything you do. Otherwise, don't do it.
Yeah. And having a strong marriage and all that, and that must have made a big difference, I mean, Carol, in your life.
It was wonderful. You know, we were never apart. You know, she'd come down to London or whatever. I mean, we're a team, you know, and that was really great. But I must say, I had most of my huge success was before I met Carol. So I don't really. What happened was I acted like the goat till about I was 27, and having had enough of the excesses of life, I thought, I've got to settle down. I've had enough of this, you know. And that was it. I made that decision, and then I got serious about my relationships or what I was looking for. Whereas before, it was just a trip on Frank Sinatra's cast-offs, you know. it got stupid, you know, and you just forget it. It wasn't living, it was just, I think a lot of the groups were like that for a long period. They just got on this roller coaster of excesses.
Yeah, the big thing I think you said actually was don't take rejection personally, you know. That's a big deal. A lot of people do.
I mean, rejection from somebody you really respect. You know, if I was doing a program on nature, and David Attenborough said to me, you know, that isn't really worth doing, I'd listen to him. But I'm not going to listen to my mate next door telling me to stop wasting my time.
Yeah.
Because they don't know from Chuck.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Harvey, I think we've come to the end. It's we could go on for about several hours, without doubt. But thank you so much for being such a groovy, wondrous source of information, storytelling, and great. And we'll revisit this in 10 years' time.